You got to remember, you know, for us, Sidemount was, you know, this was the 80s. The early 80s. There wasn't any Sidemount gear. It's kind of hard to refine something when there's nothing to begin with.
Right.
So we would take back plates and put a wing on them and sandwich it the other way, which is the toddy system now. When he showed me that in Mexico, I just looked at him and smiled and went, oh, 1981.
It's episode 78 of Dive in the Podcast with special guest Lamar Hires. Dive in the Podcast is a weekly all about diving podcast for everyone. Whether you explore the oceans as a snorkeler, scuba diver, free diver, or tech diver, Dive In has something for you. The show is filled with diving news, feature interviews with guests from around the world, interesting dive topics, and ocean advocacy. Visit diveinpod.com to find out more about the show, past guests, and our Patreon. Hi, everybody. I'm Justin, and on Gearing Up, we chat dry suit leaks.
I'm Nick, and my book recommendation takes a dive into history.
I'm Amit, and we're the hosts of Dive in the Podcast.
Before we get started on today's episode, I'd like to thank you, the listeners. Thanks for tuning in every week. Your support encourages us to keep going and make a bigger and better podcast. So what did everybody think of last week's episode with Tom and Tiffany Gear?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun, and those guys had a pile of energy.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they actually seem like they're just a bunch of people that just love having fun and going diving. So, yeah, I quite enjoyed that.
They're totally the I just thought about this, but they're totally the Brady Bunch of diving, aren't they?
Until you said it, it hadn't crossed my mind, but that could be it.
Yeah, they're just this family full of energy, like doing something they absolutely love. Mm-hmm.
Definitely an awesome interview and a fun time chatting with them.
And any excuse to talk about diving in Grenada. So.
Yeah, right.
You might have some biases there, I suppose. But, you know, I mean, think about the odds, though, of that, though, right? Like, what are the odds that in a family, like you have a family of four, but that all of them would actually be that passionate about diving? You know, because I look at that now, even in my own family, and I think, like, there's me, but I can't even convince the other two to come diving with me. So I think it's kind of neat that I
question your commitment to the sport, Amit.
Brutal. You got me there, but I'll be weeping silently inside for weeks.
Just teasing you.
Yeah, you guys probably noticed also April's not here tonight. She's got family engagement. She's tied up with a big dinner. Her sister's going out of town for a couple of years, so she won't be back for a while. So yeah, have safe travels, and April, we'll see you next week on the podcast.
Is she like never coming back for 2 years?
No, she's just
planes don't operate, or what?
Well, I mean, you never know. Like, could be COVID for the next 2 years. She might never come back. You know, she won't be able to fly. You know, won't be able to get a travel visa. Who knows?
Can't do anything there.
Yeah,
yeah. She was just. Well, I mean, I did enjoy April's, like, she said, like, her mother might murder her
if she doesn't
attend this. And I mean, I just like to put it out there because this is now publicly broadcasted. She said I could have all her time if that did happen. So, you know, just now it's on the record.
I can confirm that she said that. I saw that in the chat.
There you go.
It's all in right. triplicate because so there's one, people. Two, three of us. So, yeah, we've got it. We've got it covered.
all right.
And I had another story. That I wanted to chat about really quickly. One of our local divers who listens to the podcast, so I'm going to say, hey, Randy, he's one of the instructors at Torpedo Rays. He did literally the coolest thing a few weeks back. He went out on a boat that was doing scientific dives on the Titanic. He was a diver assisting the submersible. I believe it was the first 5-man submersible to ever go down on the Titanic. So what they did is they sailed from Newfoundland. It took, I think he said, like 6 days or something to get out there. And then they had 5 days of diving. There was some weather and some stuff. And so the submersible was so big that basically they dropped the tailgate of the boat down, and then they slid the submersible off the back, and it was on a big pontoon float. And then it sunk down 30 feet underwater. And then he and another guy would dive down, do a final set of checks, and then unbolt the submersible from the platform and then refloat the platform. And that was his job. And then getting it back on the platform at the end for those dives. What a cool gig. I'm like, Randy, how do I get on this gig? Because that sounds
amazing. I was wondering what his posts were about, but thanks for shedding light on that. And yeah, that's an awesome
trip. So here's a cool fact from that. To fund this, they allow private individuals to go in the sub. Okay, the cost is $150,000 US to go on a dive. Not guaranteed, because they had 5 dives and only did 3. Those other 2 people, out of luck. All right. So if you had to choose,
wow.
Now this is a couple hour thing, right? This is like, you know, because it takes, I don't know, something like 2 hours to go down, you know, a couple more hours to come up, so, and all the time on the bottom and all that. All right. So $150,000 to go down on the Titanic for half a day, or $250,000 to go in space on Branson's rocket, what would you do?
That's a tough one. I think I'm going to go to space, man.
You think you're going to go to space?
I think so. Because I guess the difference is I would probably be able to... too hard. It's too hard.
Here's my thinking. I think space travel is going to develop faster than we're going to be able to travel under the water in our ocean. And I think it'll be more. So if you could just get a free ticket for one pass on one of those, I think I would take the underwater. I think I'd take the Titanic because one, I'd like to see it because apparently it's degrading. And two, I think space travel, maybe before I die, will be a lot more accessible than it is right now. So I'm thinking I go down on the Titanic.
Okay, you sold me.
It kind of makes you think, right, that subsea tourism at that depth probably would have developed already by now.
Yeah.
Which is kind of surprising. And I know there's been a couple of individuals in positions of privilege that have done some pretty epic deep sea exploration, but yeah, it's interesting that, yeah, that's a really good point. I would have thought that would have developed much further by now.
Yeah. So, if any listeners have an opinion, shoot us a DM on our social medias, Dive In Pod.
Or some extra cash.
Or some extra cash
to send a pod from the bottom of the Titanic.
Yeah, we need, we're going to need, I don't know what, 600,000, so all 4 of us can go. We'll just fill the boat, I guess. And April's not here tonight, so if somebody can't go, she's last.
Okay. I like
crowdsource this.
Yeah, we can crowdsource this. Sure. Yeah. I'm sure in this day and age, we can get $500,000 together, no problem.
I mean, if diving wasn't privileged enough, we'll crowdsource a trip to the Titanic.
That would be the
ultimate privilege. Let's do it. All right. You know what is a privilege?
What's that?
To talk to Lamar Hires. That is an ultimate privilege, and we have that tonight. Lamar Hires is a pioneer in the truest sense of the word of cave exploration. Having started his career in 1979, he's driven the evolution of technical diving and cave diving through his work to standardize training, establish safety protocols, and invent and improve equipment for serious divers as the owner of DiveRite. He continues to be an active instructor, an avid cave and wreck diver who uses his lived experience to influence diving through various boards and advisory committees for some of the most prominent dive training agencies in the world. So join us as Dive In The Podcast chats with our newest friend, Lamar Hires, on this 2-part episode. Welcome to the podcast, Lamar. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad, happy to be here.
Awesome. We're happy to have you. How are you doing today?
Oh, it's been a good day.
Good day. Well, that's good. That's what we're shooting for, good days. we'll officially start your interview in a minute, Lamar, but before that, have you ever seen a blue whale in the water or out?
No. I've dived with whale sharks before. Well, swam with them, snorkeling, but never seen a blue whale.
Okay, those are pretty massive ones. Blue whales are giant as well. Locally here, a massive carcass of an endangered blue whale was washed onto shore in a popular Nova Scotia beach. A 25-meter-long blue whale washed up the shore at Crystal Crescent Beach, which is where everybody who's anybody goes to hang out during the summer in Nova Scotia. And the blue whale is it's a protected species, and there's only believed to be about 250 in the Northwest Atlantic. There was no obvious cause of death or signs of human interaction, and the Marine Animal Response Society was unable to do a necropsy because of the whale's location. It's a big, bouldery beach, and it was just a mess, so they couldn't really do that safely. They also believe it was potentially a reproducing female, which can really impact the population. So it's pretty, pretty sad to see, but really an awesome, like, literal to the word awesome, like, you know, in awe sight. Sorry, I explained that three times. Nick, you went out there and actually saw it and took some beautiful pictures of it for what it was. What was that like?
I kind of woke up and did the thing that I'm trying not to do, is check my social media as soon as I get out of bed. And sure enough, somebody had posted that they'd seen the whale the day before, and I kind of headed out there, and yeah, it's 25 meters. It's one advanced freediving course long, but beautiful beast. You know, like a little bit like Lamar said, you know, he's never seen one in the water. So they're pretty rare to sort of see live or interact with, you know, unless you're out there looking for them. So it was kind of cool. A lot of people walked down the shore to kind of witness it, even if it was dead, but it was an opportunity for people to sort of see a blue whale, right? The largest animal on the planet. So yeah, kind of sad, but I think an opportunity for people to learn and interact with. Pretty impressive sight.
And did they remove it from the beach, Nick? Do you know?
I know they were talking about trying, but still there 2 days later. It was pretty. As far as I know, it arrived on shore dead, and then it was kind of beat up in the surf because we had a hurricane come through off the coast. I don't know what they were planning on doing it, but I went back, like, I think the Friday morning or 2 days later, Saturday morning, like at sunrise, to get some nice photos, and it was pretty bloated. Yeah. I think if anything, that it wasn't going to last much longer, but I don't know what they eventually did.
Interesting. Well, I guess we'll have to find out and report back. But yeah, pretty sad, but a really interesting kind of situation there. So thanks for sharing that, Nick. That's it for the news today. It's time to actually dive in with Lamar Hires. So Lamar, can you tell us a bit about where you're from?
Well, I live in North Florida. That's where I started diving. I started diving in 1979 and, been at it for quite a few years.
Yeah. Thinking back, what was your first memory of the water, even maybe before diving?
I really didn't have that many memories of the water before diving, except swimming and such. But
yeah,
my parents, we did go on vacation up into the mountains, and I was introduced to caves at an early age.
Oh, yeah.
So when I started cave diving, my father was very upset and wanted to know how I ever got into it. I just looked at him and said, "Dad, don't you remember the vacation you took us on?" And he didn't know what to say after that.
Yeah.
What is it that first attracted you to scuba diving? What got you started there?
Well, you know, I started in 79. So, you know, I grew up watching Sea Hunt, Flipper, all the Jacques Cousteau stuff. So living in Florida, it just seemed like the natural thing to do, to learn to scuba dive. So that's what. So I learned to scuba dive when I was working at a chemical plant, and there was another single guy there, and we were both interested. So, I have a dive buddy. So we learned to scuba dive together.
Nice. How was that first scuba course?
Well, you know, we were very adventuresome. So we finished our last dive, and the instructor turns us loose and says, "Okay, guys, you know, go out, but, you know, kind of stay close to shore and don't go to the bottom." Well, what do? We go out to the middle and go to the bottom. Fortunately, it was only 40 foot deep, but we got stuck in mud on the bottom. I thought we were going to lose our fins. Oh, wow. So ever since then, it's like, you know, just don't tell me not to do something.
I know a few divers like that. We're going to get into the details in a bit, but in general terms, what was your progression like in diving? So how did you kind of evolve from that first dive course to going to, you know, recreational and then eventually the technical route?
Well, you got to remember, it was 1979. Okay. Courses weren't as structured as they are today. Everything that we know today were, it's like, you don't go in a cave or an overhead environment unless you're trained.
Right.
Well, back then, there wasn't any of that. You know, there weren't any signs telling you to stay out or anything like that. There weren't state parks down in Florida that catered to cave divers. Matter of fact, most of the sites that had caves were not state parks yet. So you just pull up and go diving. And after a couple of swims in the basin area, you get pretty bored and you go inside.
Right.
And there's nothing there, nobody to tell you you're doing something wrong or anything else. So since I lived in Jacksonville, there was no offshore diving in Jacksonville unless you had your own boat. So it was either 5 hours south to West Palm or an hour and a half over to the Springs.
Hmm.
So started the Springs, which then turned into cave diving.
Hmm. Wow. That's a pretty cool story.
Yeah.
So I was cave diving without realizing that's what I was doing within a couple of months of finishing my open water course.
Wow.
Yeah. Was there a point there where you thought maybe I need to get a little more training, or maybe I need to find somebody to get some training from?
Well, at that point, in that time, there really wasn't a lot to be said about getting training mm-hmm. after you got your open water card,
yeah.
unless you were going on to be an instructor.
Right.
You know, there wasn't all these take these advanced courses or anything like that. You get certified and you get a tank and a rig and you go diving. And so we saw a few cave divers out in the field, but you know, back then they didn't talk to you. So you kind of left on your own to figure stuff out. Hmm. So we just went into these places. We had a couple of close calls, but you know, we came out. So, well, have a beer and talk about it. Yeah. Hmm. But that's it. Yeah. You know, there wasn't any of this. Yeah, oh my God, I almost died. It was just, you know, but I had some close calls. I mean, I did emergency free ascent from 70 feet, 100 feet back in a cave one day. Came out uh-huh. and it was like, okay, well, let's go fill the tanks again.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize I'd done anything wrong.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's just like, I just won't do that again.
Right. And I understand it was one of these instances, filling tanks that you might've run into a legendary cave diver. Are you able to tell us a little bit about that? Who might've shaped you some of your diving?
Yeah. That was Wes Giles, Pro Dive Center in Jacksonville that turned into Aquifer Dive Center. He was just back from being in Jamaica, teaching and running a boat over there. And Mike and I, that was my dive buddy I learned to dive with. We had gone to different shops other than the one we got certified at. We just didn't have the right atmosphere for us. Yeah. So Aquifer was just down the street. So we got tanks pumped there. And Wes had been working on the compressor. So there were hot fills, took a long time. So we chatted a lot. But he didn't charge us for the fills. So we came back. And after a couple of times there getting fills, he asked us what we were doing that day. And I told him, well, we're going to Orange Grove again. You know, grabbed his chest like he was having a heart attack. And I'm like, what's wrong? And he's like, you're going to Orange Grove? Yeah, we've been there before. We're going back. And he pulled down a blueprint to survival off the shelf and said, here, guys, take this and read it on your way there. I looked at it, and it was like $2.95. And I went, that's a six-pack. We'll pick it up later. And he said, oh, I'm giving it to you. Just promise me you'll read it. And so that day, Mike was driving. I was sitting in the passenger seat. I'm thumbing through the book. I'm going, Mike, listen to this. I read it to him. It's like, Mike, this was our dive last week, but these guys died. And we're like, oh, shit. Okay. Went back. Wes, you got our attention. Where do we go from here?
Wow.
So we did advanced open water with him. Didn't even know that was possible back then. And then went right into cave diving. And actually, our advanced open water class was actually accelerated cavern diving.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's how we met Wes, and that he moved into the same apartment complex we were living in, and we became dive buddies, and remember quite a few adventures with him and what we called the gang, the cave divers out of Jacksonville.
Wow. And so I guess who were the gang when you know, put, because I mean, at that time, I imagine this gang would have been a number of legendary divers, right? Like this, if you're diving with Wes Giles.
We didn't really hang out with Shaq, but that's where Shaq got his gas and everything. Mm-hmm. And okay. It was Shaq, Clark McCarran, Mark Ullman, and quite a few others. I really don't remember that much. Ned DeLoach, Paul DeLoach. Mm-hmm. Paul didn't really come in the shop much because he was based out of Georgia. Mm. But they all kind of made their way there because they were all dive buddies. And that's how we kind of got our hands on maps and everything, because Sheck would bring them in and kind of show the guys what he was doing, and they would make copies of them. So those copies, those copies were coveted.
Yeah, I can imagine. So now they say kind of hindsight's 20/20, right? When you look at this stuff. And do you think that you would have been exploring caverns and caves successfully if you had not met Wes before that day?
Yeah, quite so. Very much so. Because Wes taught us a lot, but we also introduced Wes to some things. Rock Bluff Springs, the cave that we explored back in, we actually surveyed and mapped with Wes back in 81 as part of our full cave course. But we had already found it and checked it out and knew what was going on. We told Wes about it. And then Wes took us, and then we took Wes there and went through the restriction that had stopped Sheck Exley and Mary Ellen Nutkoff. And Mike and I had already been through it and got stuck and came out.
Oh, wow.
And then that's when Wes taught us how to survey, because we'd found a cave. So we were already bitten by the bug and wanted to do it. Wes just kind of, Wes made sure we didn't do anything too stupid.
But we've got a friend like that.
Yeah. We became good dive buddies. I mean, he was my cave instructor. And actually, Mike and I were his first full cave students. He was already a very active cavern instructor and such, but we were his first full cave students back in 1980.
If we could have Wes Scales here on as a guest, we would, but maybe you can tell us a little bit about him as a person.
I always like to say Wes was like a cat with nine lives. I know, because I survived seven of them with him. We did some crazy stuff because we just didn't know any better. You know, going into places, caves, and pushing tanks ahead of us. And throwing them through the hole, knowing that, okay, well, we have to get through because we've already pushed our tanks on the other side. You know, doing things like that, doing some dry caves and some sumps. And I remember one in particular where we got to this place that Wes had found through one of the guides we were in. And we got there and we were doing the dry cave. And it was just that day from hell. He had his camera and everything with him and his pack, and he dropped his pack 50 foot down the hole. We're like, Wes, how's the camera? He just shook the pack, and you could hear everything rattling inside. And then we're going in, and we're like, Wes, this description's not really fitting everything. These are fresh leaves 15 feet above our head. This place floods regularly. Oh, well, maybe it does. Well, Wes, there was a thunderstorm brewing outside. So now it's a mad rush to get back out. You know, so there were a lot of adventures like that. I mean, side mount exploration, when we were doing all that, what we did in Florida here was not like what they did in the UK, where they started it first. Side mount was just because they needed to get through a nuisance water hole, a pea trap, so to speak, in a dry cave. So half the time they didn't care about buoyancy or anything else. They wouldn't even put fins on. They just flip a tank on and walk through so they could get to the dry portion. Where everything we did was to try to go into places that our mentors, Sheck, Mary Ellen, Paul Heinrich, well, not Paul so much. Paul was there, but Paul was also adventuresome too. But some of the stuff he'd done, but Paul DeLoach and those guys had stopped at. So for us, with our generation, it was like, okay, well, our exploration was one of two ways. One, a small cave that they wouldn't go into because it was too small for back mount, or go to the end of where they had stopped in back mount and see if it was still going if we went to a different tank configuration. So that was Rock Bluff. Rock Bluff was one of those. I would never forget the day Mary Ellen Nutkoff came into Branford Dive Center. And we were excited because we had broke through the restriction that stopped her in Sheck. And it was only 200 feet in, but we broke through it and told her it was still going. And all she could say was, you guys are going to die doing that side mount stuff. No one's going to be able to get you because you guys are going places nobody else can go. Oh, Mary Ellen, I thought you would be excited we found something, but she was upset that we were going into these small caves. So we had to really stop talking about it around her after that. So, but that's how we gravitated towards side mount. So for what we were doing, I think it was a whole lot more dangerous than what they ever did in the UK. It's because we were putting ourselves into small environments that we didn't know if it was going to go. It might have to back out, might have to be pulled out. Woody Jasper is the one who invented the signal to pull me out if I get stuck, which is crossing the fence. And had to do that more than once.
And so, I mean, you're kind of explaining the, you know, the true evolution of side mount when you hear about this now. And we actually had another guest, Audrey Cadell, was talking about this as well, the difference between the side mount as it was evolving in the UK and then side mount as it was evolving in Florida. Yeah. And so what, like, was it just a thing of necessity that started building this need for side mount? Were you really refining kit and, you know, developing harnesses and stuff at that point to fine tune it?
No.
as you were making that transition, or how'd you do it?
No. You got to remember, you know, for us, side mount was, you know, this was the 80s. The early 80s, there wasn't any side mount gear. It's kind of hard to refine something when there's nothing to begin with.
Right.
So we would take back plates and put a wing on them and sandwich it the other way, which is the Toddy system now. When he showed me that in Mexico, I just looked at him and smiled and went, oh, 1981. You know? And it's like, I can tell you about the guys who got stuck using that system because we were all thinking about small cave, not just lifestyle. Side mount today is all about lifestyle. It is not the hardcore exploration that it was designed for. So we would modify, we would take wings and try to hold them down with harnesses. And then we went to jacket style BCs. All of that to be able to get the lift distributed around so we could, you know, carry the tanks. And it was always steel tanks. It was never aluminum. Today, you'll hear guys talk about, oh, you only dive aluminums and all this, because it's back to the lifestyle thing. In Mexico, where that's all they've got are aluminums. But we had steels, we had deep caves, and we had high flow. More gas was better.
Yeah.
And if you can go, oh, well, you can carry 380s rather than those two big 104s. I went, no. If I can carry the 104s, I'm still going to carry an 80 or two, okay, because I'm going to need that extra gas. So it was always about the big tanks. So everything we were designing was to be able to get into these small caves and or just get through some tight restrictions so we could explore some big cave on the other side. We had a few adventures like that when it came to getting through restrictions to be able to explore cave. But the refinement of the systems came later on. I'm not sure if I've talked about this before, but 1996, I had the opportunity to go to Japan on expedition. So I went up into a remote area of Japan in the Iwate Prefecture and explored a narrow karst belt, 2 clicks wide by 25 clicks long. And it had a number of caves in it. And my first venture there, we went during the summer, and everything was very restricted because the caves were in the mountains and they were flood. So after I got there and saw what we were up against, we had to go back with side mount, but the ability to be able to carry our gear for thousands of feet in, climb, crawl, and then, okay, can I still wear them on my back or do they have to be side mount? Be able to climb them and get them up and down these waterfalls. So that's when the Transpac was born. It came out of my trips to Japan to develop a rig that I could carry gear for long distances through a cave, dive it back mount, side mount, and climb. So I've got no video of us climbing waterfalls back there in 38 degree water.
Wow.
Testing all this and pushing the cave back over a mile through 6 sumps. I mean, miles. But it was all through that refinement of need. It was never about trying to develop cool looking system or whatever else. It was all about, okay, what's the obstacles in this next cave we're trying to explore? Everything was designed around that. And that's why there were so many evolutions.
So what did you think it felt like? Like, you know, I mean, that's a really cool thing to have done, which is like to develop the kit to go in there and to actually like go and search through those areas of caves. But what does it feel like to really push through into like that unexplored part of the world where nobody's been before?
There's nothing like it. I'll never be an astronaut. This will be as close as I ever come to be an astronaut. I've had the privilege of you know, being the first one to swim through in areas no one else has been. Mm-hmm. To go in places that have stopped other people and go back and figure out what held them up and how to push it on. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. That's the thrill. The equipment to me, I enjoy it, but it's just a tool. It's mm-hmm. like, I look at this next dive and say, all right, well, that didn't work. This got me hung up. That needs to be able to unclip faster and look at things to make that next exploration bit a little bit easier to do.
And so I guess when I look at this too, I'm also, there's a piece that's kind of coming up to the forefront for me, which is what you're describing as, you know, quote unquote, cave diving in those days mm-hmm. is significantly different to potentially what cave diving might be today. Like, can you, you know, can you give us a bit of a background on say maybe how that compared, those early days of cave diving compared to now? I mean, we'll get into standards and protocols later on in the interview, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
There's been a few things out there with, I guess, you know, there's a few, you know, pages, you know, Facebook pages. We were cave diving in the 70s, you know, and such like that. Guy Bryan does a good job of putting that Facebook page together. But today people take for granted everything. I've been criticized for calling a lot of what's done today recreational cave diving. Mm-hmm. People look at me, cave diving's recreational? Like, there's a state park that has benches set up for your tanks. There's a kiosk there with the map. And all of your diving is based around planning a dive from a map that you're looking at a kiosk. Mm-hmm. It's no different from going into a state park and deciding on which trail you're going to walk. Mm-hmm. Okay. I come from the time when there's a hole. And one, how are we going to get in the hole? Two, how deep is it? Where does it go? Is the flow with us or against us? Don't know. I'll let you know when I come back. Mm-hmm. So everything is planned on the fly. Now it's, you know, dive, you know, plan your dive and dive your plan. Well, how can you plan a dive if you are having to constantly run tables in your head the whole time you're down there to see if you had enough gas for decompression, if you got into decompression? You know, Navy tables. I make jokes with people when I just run the tables at them going, okay, you know, what's the 100-foot, what's your time in deco for 100-foot schedule? They look at me like I'm crazy. And I'm like, 50 is 2 and 24, 60 is 9 and 28, 70 is 17 and 39, 80 is 23 and 48, and 90 is 23 and 57. Oh, it's like, we had to run that constantly through our head to know if we needed oxygen back at the entrance. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have oxygen tables back then. So today, like I said, I call it recreational cave diving. When you can look at a map, plan your dive, plan your deco, and know what you need before you get in the water, rather than, okay, the real explorer and the adventure, I don't know. I'll tell you when I get back.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's quite saying something. I mean, you know, when you get right down to it, paints a completely different picture and super, super cool to hear as well. Yeah. And so, yeah. I mean, one of the things, and I think you've kind of touched about or on that is, when you were doing this, this wasn't a thing where now it seems like there's a course for everything. And I'm not crapping on that because I do think like,
because of the numbers, we need that.
Right.
No, I come from the day of the chicken or the egg.
I like it. And so do you think, like, is that really, you know, the type of diving that was required to sort of push the innovation of the equipment and standardization of training as you guys went and did this? Because there must have been some point when you're doing all of that where you just thought, like, hey, you know, now there's more people following me into these caves, and I'm ending up in a position where, like, people are coming to me for advice and or suggestions on things. Is that what kind of drove some of your innovation and the work that you did in standardization of training?
Well, yes, it did, because one of the things, and I've talked to a couple of cave divers at sites, you know, it's like they're doing something and their entire rig, none of it is part of standards, and none of it complies with any of them, and he'll talk to my student or somebody going, oh, well, I do this because of this, this, and this. And then I'll pull them to the side and go, you shouldn't be doing that. I said, it's not about just what you told him, because I'm going to go back and tell him everything you said was wrong. Two, people that you don't talk to but see you doing that think it's cool to do it that way. You're justifying people doing things the wrong way, mm-hmm. because they see you do it and they just assume that's the way it's done. It's like the 7-foot hose, for example. You know, that whole thing with a long hose for cave diving, which is not the standard for all technical diving. There was a lot of things that happened to make that come about. One, side mounting. We never took a long hose side mounting. You know, it was two short hoses, and usually one of them was always a Poseidon or something that would be a left-handed regulator. So we could take them from both sides. We didn't route hoses around necks or anything, because we were side mounting. We were going into places where, okay, we're a buddy team as long as we can see each other. But if we can't, and when we can't, you're on your own. Mm-hmm. Sharing gas, it's like that was never part of the equation. But today it's all about the long hose and things like that. And there's a place for it, don't get me wrong, because we just updated some standards here where, you know, every cave diver should have a long hose with them, just in case you're called on to assist somebody who is not mm-hmm. part of your dive team or anything. You can't help out in any kind of emergency or rescue situation unless you're equipped to do that. And to do that, you have to have a long hose. Mm-hmm. But the whole battle between 5 and 7 all came about in 86 with scooters. Because mm-hmm. before that, it was a 5-foot hose.
Right.
And it wasn't until scooters came out that I had to deal with the battles between the guys riding Aquaseps at Eagle's Nest on an 11-foot hose. Then and then some of the guys running Technus saying 9-foot is needed. Mm. And then, you know, the battle between what was an ideal hose length. So I remember Wes, Mark Long, and me doing a lot of test runs to figure out what would be the right length hose to recommend. And it was all compromise. So we settled on 7 because 5s had the most for regular divers, and then 9s were catching on for the scooter divers, for the guys riding DPVs. But it was too long because the only way to manage it was to do one wrap around your neck, which now you've got a chokehold if somebody pulls on that hose. So we split the difference, 7. And then Bill Main blessed it because he figured out how to configure that properly by hooking it under his canister on his right-hand side. Mm. And then that would make it be the right length. So that's where all that discussion came into be, and why we set it on 7, because it was easy to stow and would still be a good length for proper scooter towing. Once we determined that the scooter people were going to gravitate to the most were a toe behind and not a ride on.
That's really interesting hearing the history of that. Like, I mean, things you know, but things you don't know about, you know. Yeah. So that's
yeah.
awesome.
Yeah, my mind is totally blown here.
Yeah. I wanted to know what led you to write the first side mount cave course for NSS CDS.
Well, it was becoming quite the people were wanting to see some of the caves that we were exploring at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, people were wanting to see Rock Bluff. Now, Rock Bluff, we didn't explore on side mount. We were young and thin. We were able to explore Rock Bluff on back-mounted 80s.
Okay.
But then after that, the guys who wanted to follow us couldn't get into the cave on back mount. So side mount was what they wanted to do there. And then places like Cow Springs that we explored back in 86, 85, 86 area, to get into the cave, there were three restrictions. The first one was called the Hellbender. Then we had two more, and then you landed on what we called the beach. That was at 30 foot. And it was 20, 25 minutes to get six tanks apiece in for three divers. Just down to 30 foot, we've only covered a distance of about 40 feet.
Wow.
And then the dive would start from there. So you had to go side mount to see this beautiful cave. So more and more people were gravitating to wanting to try side mount. It hadn't turned into a lifestyle thing yet. It was just more about seeing some of these small caves that we were talking about and mapping. Telford Lurville, when we connected it, the only way to be able to do that traverse or see the Lurville side was with side mount. And then Cal, and then there were a few other little springs, Running Springs, Swanee Springs, that in order to see them, you had to go side mount. Beautiful caves. But it wasn't that the whole dive was side mount. It was usually just to get through a few restrictions. So with that growing, I had to write a course because people didn't know how to manage their gas. Didn't know how to balance them. You know, they were trying to figure out, oh, a third on this tank and a third on that tank. Well, you can't do that because if you have a problem with one, you're not going to have enough gas in the other to get you out. Keep them balanced, but have a simple formula for them, keeping them within 500 PSI of each other. And that was the simple formula. There have been a lot of variations on that, but it hasn't changed in the fact that never let them get more than 500 PSI apart for balancing. And then it was just some of the configuration and hose routing. And back then, the first course was still around, you know, basically being, you know, solo as a team. So long hoses were not required. It was just, you know, get the hoses the right length so you can actually breathe off of them. And we didn't really promote taking tanks off or anything. I'd already been there squeezing through a restriction in Cal.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for a 5-foot hose, I would have lost a tank and probably died that day. Because I was trying to push it ahead. I was trying to push it ahead through a crack and I lost my grip on it.
Oh.
So I was hanging by the hose on it. And I was able to slowly pull it up and get my hand back around the valve. And I went, okay, well, that doesn't work. So anyway, a long hose, you know, became, you know, something to do. But some of the stuff that morphed out of that still makes me laugh today, because they'd be like, well, this, you know, Jim Fishback, you know, a side mounter that worked for me. Yeah, he's like, well, he dives 7-foot hoses on both sides. Isn't that the way to do it? And I'd laugh and like, no, Jim's got back problems. He dives side mount as a lifestyle. He got tired of answering the questions about which regulator are you going to be breathing on and which one are you going to give me. So he decided just to put long hoses on both tanks so he wouldn't have to have that discussion anymore. Okay. And then the other one, the one that got me more than any was my buddy Woody Jasper. I actually consider him the grandfather of side mounting as we know it.
Okay.
Today, the Florida style. Where I worked on the equipment a lot, he was more the innovator as into how to rig the tanks and the bungees and stuff like that, inner tube. And Woody put a long hose on a 7-foot hose on one of his tanks. They were like, well, Woody's diving a long hose tomorrow. Shouldn't we all be doing that? And I just started laughing. It's like, don't you see what regulator that's on? It's on a Poseidon. This is 1983. A long Poseidon hose, all metric, cost about $100. This is back in 83. He was not going to let that thing go to waste. It was on his back mount and his side mount because it cost too damn much to let it sit around. Everybody, you know, put more into why he was running a long hose. Yeah. So he paid for it. He's going to use it.
That's wow. Very pragmatic approach.
You know, today it seems like everything has to have why is that a small clip rather than a large clip? It must be a reason. Not, well, yeah, that's what I had in my tool bag.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
you know, back then we were cobbling stuff together.
Yeah, you've described SideMount as a lifestyle today. Can you kind of elaborate on what you mean by that?
Well, today, people either aging out, and I can say that because I'm 65, okay, and I still dive all styles, but, you know, having back problems or just, you know, problems in general and don't want to carry doubles or can't carry doubles, it becomes a lifestyle way to dive rather than carrying doubles on you. For some people, balancing a set of twins on your back and getting the trim out in them without going head first or whatever, side mount works out better because it's like a canoe with outriggers on it. Mm-hmm. So it's much easier to balance yourself if you can get everything trimmed out for your tank positioning so you stay horizontal in the water. Mm. And then you have the old, you know, I can't reach my valves on my back. So I side mount, now I can reach my valves. So now it's the techie lifestyle mode to be able to accomplish everything a back mounter does, but to be able to do it with ease because his valves are very readily accessible. He can do his own leak checks, especially if solo diving.
That's very cool. And so I wanted to go back a tiny bit into some of the work that you were doing in around, like, you know, keeping people safe as they were learning these skills as cave divers. And years ago, you participated in a video called A Deceptively Easy Way to Die. It was with the NSS CDS. And I found that was like a pretty fair, frank discussion. And it's really relevant today, even like as long as you've done it, but it's still quite relevant today. Yeah. What was the intent that you had behind that video? And do you feel that it accomplished the goal?
I think it did. Yeah. When we did that, we were on the tail end of the time when basically I want to call far the Wild West. Okay. Mm-hmm. It was very popular for open water training. Troy Springs was still open. You know, you just paid the kid a quarter, you'd open, close the gate, and you could go dive it. It wasn't a state park anymore. The Peacock and those places, I think, were not state parks at the time. But I think we did that with, I'm not sure if we did. Well, no, they were coming about to be state parks. They're already state parks, but there were still a lot of people coming down, not being trained. Mm-hmm. And I've supervised 30 body recoveries and I've done 23 of them and I've done two rescues. And that was at a height after I'd already done about 16 recoveries. So it was a very important message to get out, because we were just getting to a point where training agencies were actually recognizing cave diving. So they would, since they actually had, we'd gotten everybody on board with teaching the CAFRM program, they had to actually talk about caves, tell people to stay out and to avoid them unless you get trained. So it was a message that people would actually use during their classes to warn people about the hazards of going into an overhead environment with training. Most of the recoveries I did were, you know, typical scenario for what happened at Peacock. You know, first dive at Peacock, there's no local dive shop, so the half full tank, they would go over to Orange Grove and they would get into a silty condition and starting the dive with less than 1500 PSI and not enough time or reserve to even figure out which way's out.
Wow.
So I think it's still relevant there. There's been a couple of attempts at a remake on it. But, you know, that one right there for what we put into it and the time we did it when there were so many open water fatalities happen, I think was a stronger message than a remake today where we don't have that anymore. We solved that problem. Today it's the occasional cave diver going beyond his limits, doing something he shouldn't be doing. Where back then it was all open water divers who were just totally naive that they were fixing to get into a problem.
Right. Mm. Yeah. So it really was timely. Does kind of still hold a lot of relevance for today.
All right. Let's just take a quick break here and we'll be back with more. Stay tuned.
This episode of Dive In the Podcast is brought to you by Torpedo Rays Scuba.
You can find them online at torpedorays.com.
They've been teaching Canada how to dive for 25 years and are a proud sponsor of this podcast.
If you're in Atlantic Canada and want to take a course or see the shop, stop in and see us in Dartmouth and check out the huge selection of scuba, apnea, surf gear, and much more.
Dive tours are available for locals and visitors to experience all that our ocean playground has to offer.
TorpedoRays.com has a vast selection of dive gear at unbeatable prices, with free shipping available in Canada and quick shipping throughout North America.
So visit TorpedoRays.com or stop in the shop and you might even see one of us there.
All right, welcome back to Dive in the Podcast, everybody. We spent the last hour chatting with Lamar Hires of Dive Right and just about everything you've ever learned in scuba diving. So this interview was pretty long. It actually clocked in just under 2 hours, so we split it in two. You've just listened to part one. Part two will be available next week, starting September 27th. So make sure you come back and listen to the conclusion of our interview with Lamar Hires. Still, my mind's still blown over that interview with Lamar, and that was a lot of fun. And really, I just want to go home now. So, well, I guess home. I am home, but yeah. You know, I'm like, how can we? What, you know? It was like we had the main show before the warm up act, and so yeah. Anyway, I'm going to talk to you tonight about gearing up, and I was going to start talking about some dry suit stuff, but something came up today in our group chat, and April's not here and she was leak testing a dry suit. And I was thinking about this and I was like, before I get too far into dry suit stuff, I should really kind of tell everybody, although it's really not gearing up, more of a, I don't know, pro tip, how to leak test your dry suit. Cause you can do it at home with all the stuff you have. Like, do you need to go out and buy a new dry suit? Can you repair it? Is it repairable? Do you want to do a leak test? Do you want to take it to the dive shop and pay for the leak test? I mean, not that I'm trying to talk, you know, your local dive shop out of any money.
You no longer manage,
but like, giving the tips away. But I just, you know, I've been gone a week and now I'm, you know, telling people how to do stuff at home. But like, I don't know. I think simple repairs you can definitely do on your own, and there's no reason you shouldn't be able to. So what I'm going to start with on this gearing up segment about dry suits is about how to leak test a dry suit. And the biggest thing, so you got a couple holes that you have to take care of in your dry suit. You generally have wrist seals and you have a neck seal. There's a lot of ways to do this. I've found over lots and lots of trial and error, the easiest thing to use to plug up your wrists if you don't have dry gloves that lock closed is literally just a coffee cup, like a thermos travel mug that doesn't have a handle on the side, because generally they get bigger as they go up the top, and you can wedge it right through the wrist seals. It works amazingly well, and they don't shoot out or anything when you pressurize the suit. All right. The neck seal can be more complicated. If you have a neoprene neck seal, I found almost by far the best way to do is take two very smooth pieces of wood and clamp them together over the neck seal. Fold the neck seal over, just like a little dry bag, give it a little roll, clamp it down, and clamp it down hard with some clamps, and that works. I've seen some people use a piece of bungee, just like tie it up, almost like a balloon, if you imagine tying a balloon tight with a bungee. I do that with latex seals. It works great on latex seals. I haven't had a lot of success on neoprene. So neoprene I like to clamp. Latex seals I like to wrap around. Imagine like you're just holding a little balloon, and instead of tying a normal knot in it, you tie around a bungee and then tie a couple half hitches and it stays closed. Okay, so now we've got the opening closed, right? The wrist and the neck. How do you get air in it? Well, the first thing I do is I turn the dry suit inside out. Even if it's got big bulky boots, everything has layers on the outside and there's pockets and all that stuff. So it's really easy for a leak to be hidden in the wrong spot. So you're going to turn the suit inside out, and now you're going to need to zip the dry suit up, and you're going to need to put air in it. So the way you put air in it is you take the inflator valve out, flip it around. So now that the nipple's on the outside and it's shooting air into the inside that was the outside of your inside out suit, you can use your scuba regulator, your normal regulator, to inflate the suit. So this works really well. I've seen other complicated ways of using like air guns and all kinds of stuff, bicycle pumps, like stand-up paddleboard pumps, but just use the gear you've already got. It's super simple. It works every time. The only trick can be is getting that zipper zipped And if your zipper is not, is kind of stiff, sometimes you'll need to stick your arm inside the neck seal. So you might need to tie the neck seal up after you get everything else closed up. Sequence can be important.
Yeah.
Sometimes it bites you in the butt if you do it in the wrong sequence. Sometimes it doesn't. Just kind of, if you got one of those nice, easy, well lubricated zippers, then it's not a big deal. You can just close it right up. But if you've got a zipper that you haven't been taking care of, then it could be a little harder to get closed.
Might also be why your suit's leaking, because you're not looking after
might it. Always be exactly. and your deflation valve is now inside out because it was working before, and so now the out is on the inside and the in is on the outside. So when you pressurize the suit, it shouldn't leak. Nothing will happen there. So now what I'm going to do is I hook up my inflator, punch the button, press and hold 5 to 10 minutes, and it's going to inflate nice and big. And I'll usually inflate it until the neck seal starts to expand and look like it's getting dangerous, because I want to get as much air in there as possible, many PSIs, as many bars as I can. And I've never measured the pressure that I've gotten inside a dry suit, but it's got to be pretty high. You want a nice full suit. I'm going to spray the dry suit down with water, get it nice and wet. And then I've also seen lots of ways to do this, different sprays, different bottles of stuff. But I literally just pour a nice big blob of dish soap in my hands, spread it around between my hands, and then start rubbing it into the suit. And then do that all over the suit. You won't see any leaks right now, but just keep rubbing the suit in, get the whole suit nice and soapy. And this is also just going to clean the shit out of the inside of your suit. It's going to be wonderful. once you've got the suit covered in a nice kind of foam, you'll know when you see it. If you're just rubbing in this plain soap into kind of a damp wetsuit or dry suit. Now take your garden hose or whatever you have and just mist ever so slightly the outside of the suit and just give it a minute. And what'll happen is as that water trickles down over the soap and over the hole in your suit, you'll see a little trail bubbles. Or you'll see a little kind of like mustache of bubbles on a seam where they're kind of just building up. So this is really easy to do a lake test, and you'll need a grease pencil or something to mark the spot. Your Sharpie will not last more than about 5 minutes of marking. So paint pens don't work because it's wet. Grease pencil is basically the only thing that works. So get one that's a good color and then mark your spot. You will have to remove the grease pencil before you glue it if you're going to do your own repair. But we'll talk about repairs on a dry suit on another time. So that's the leak test. The only other thing that sometimes is a little easier is if you have, like I said, if you have dry gloves, you can put your dry gloves on instead of shoving something through the wrist seals. And if you have a leak in the boots, it can be hard to kind of diagnose, because if you're doing the inside out, the boots will be basically inside the suit because you can't turn them inside out. So anyway, there's a little bit to it, and it's not hard. I recommend everyone give it a try. Before saying, oh, this dry suit sucks, I have to, spend $1,000 on repairing it, or, oh, this dry suit sucks, I need a new one. Well, maybe you should give it a leak test and see. That's it. That's my dry suit rant on gearing up tonight.
I think it fits really...
All right, I like it.
I think it fits really nicely with the interview we just had, right? But with Lamar doing, doing a lot of tinkering and gear development, and I think it's a great skill for divers to be able to have, especially if you're there's a lot of people that don't live close to a dive shop too, right? They might be, they might only pop into the dive shop very infrequently, and, it might save them an hour to drive into the dive shop and sort something up.
Yeah, and let's face it, no dive shop's getting rich off of leak tests, so I'm not worrying about stealing in business from Torpedo Rays or any other dive shop in the listening area, which is the world. So
I gotta say, to your point, Justin, on I know I just cut you off there, but to your point, I will say, having done that leak test and having you showed it to me, it is super easy. It takes a little bit of time, but I was ready to trade my suit in on at least two different occasions until you were actually saying, it's just this, man, just get it fixed and it'll be no problem. And, realistically, being smart about doing that leak test is probably going to save you a couple of grand as well. Right. So definitely good skill, and don't judge the suit, because since my last one, and I've had this happen to me probably 3 to 5 times. Anything that you stick in the ocean hundreds of times over and over again is going to leak. So I will say that, you know, having had my suit repaired 5 times, it's last forever. And it kind of keeps kicking, and it gives me hard probable cause to go out and buy a new one, although I'm still looking for that probable cause.
So you're judging the suit from the inside, not the cover.
Mm-hmm. Not exactly. Yes.
Judge a suit by its inside.
That's right. So, you know, if anyone wants to donate a suit to me, say Fourth Element Seal dry suits. Right. I heard something about them being amazing for side mount. Yeah. Right. Look me up.
All right. Yeah. Remember, don't judge a suit
by its cover. Don't judge a suit by the, I don't even know what's going here. I don't know. Just stop. Like, we just got to cut it out.
All right. Without any further ado, Nick, you've got a book recommendation.
Yeah,
is that a word? Covers. Did I say book recommendation?
Yeah. So the book recommendation in this episode is going to be the book called Shadow Divers by Robert Kirsten. And the subtitle is The True Adventure of Two Americans Who Risked Everything to Solve One of the Last Mysteries of the Second World War. And it's really the story about John Chatterton and Richie Kohler and the discovery of a U-boat about 100 kilometers off the coast of New Jersey, and the eventual identification of the wreck. So I'm not going to give away sort of the name of the wreck, I mean, unless you've already heard the story or read the book or Googled it. But it's really one of those, you know, really cool adventure stories where, you know, somebody finds something and it sort of then leads them down this rabbit hole trying to identify, you know, what this German U-boat is, which one it is, because there was basically no record of one having sunk where it was. And it actually, the story takes place over several years, several diving seasons. The wreck itself, if I remember correctly, is in something like 250 feet, 270 feet of water, something like that. So pretty deep. But it also takes us to the era before Trimix was a thing. So in the early days of them trying to dive this wreck regularly to identify it, they were using air. And obviously narcosis and decompression were real issues at those depths. And then at some point they start experimenting with Trimix and were some of the first divers on the East Coast to do so. Also, sadly, there were fatalities involved. These dives were far off the coast and sometimes in really rough conditions and fairly deep and occasionally dangerous. So Robert Kirsten weaves this really interesting story and really keeps the mystery of the identity of the wreck right up until the last minute and sort of really delves into, you know, the effort it took for Chatterton and Kohler to actually make a positive identification of the U-boat in question. So if you want a sort of real knuckle reader, I suggest you pick up a copy of Shadow Divers.
Isn't that like part of the Paddy Open Water manual? Like there's just the middle of it's all that book. You have to read it. I don't know. That's the way it felt for me anyway. Back when I started diving, I think that was the very first book I read about scuba diving.
It's pretty cool, eh?
Yeah, it's a great book. Yeah. Great book. Everybody should read it. And one day we definitely need to get John Chatterton or Richard Kohler on the podcast. So if there's anyone that hasn't read it, make sure to read it.
And for those fans of audiobooks, the actual book has photos in it that are actually really awesome. So, you know, I'm going to steer you towards the print copy for the lazy ones out there.
I love it. Yeah, just try to exercise your reading skills. Is that what you're saying here, Nick?
I'm the king of audiobooks, and I have the print copy. So,
okay. Fair enough.
I guess there probably wasn't a lot of audiobooks when I started diving. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, I think that's it. Is that it? That's it. That's it for the show today. Yeah. I want to thank Lamar Hires for part one of his interview with us. Stay tuned next week. Same bat time, same bat channel for part two. It just gets better. It's awesome. Lamar is a really great guy. I've already heard part two. You guys will have to come back and listen to it next week. And see what there is for that. I also want to thank Amit. You set up that interview. You did all of the legwork on this one. Thanks, Amit. Awesome job, man.
It was a good time. It was definitely team effort. I can't take credit for that. Nick kind of helped me quite a bit in terms of getting the logistics sorted out. So, yeah, happy to be able to help out in getting that done. And obviously a legend in diving and, you know, one of these guys who was literally there from the beginning. So, you know, I'm enjoying it. I'm going to save some of my ranting for the end of episode two. So hoping everyone joins us back in for episode two when we finish off with Lamar.
Definitely. And Nick, thanks for helping out quite a bit.
Well, you know, I'm going to give credit where credit is due because Amit really was passionate about this one and really put in the legwork for the research and the background stuff. And I think that's kind of what makes the interviews great here when we have good questions to ask our awesome guests. So thanks to the team.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And April, hope you survived dinner with your mother. And we'll see you. We'll see. Well, I guess maybe we'll see her next week. I don't know how this is going to work, guys. This is challenging. Don't forget, you can support the podcast at patreon.com/diveinpod and get some fun rewards for doing so. You can visit our website, diveinpod.com, for all the links you need, episodes, merch, and so much more. On social media, you can follow me at iDiveOK. April is at April Weichert.
I'm at Nicholas Winkler Photography.
And next week, we're going to chat with Lamar a little bit more.
Part two. This episode of Dive in the Podcast was brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Ray Scuba.
You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or at podchaser.com. Reviews are one of the best ways to help others find the podcast.
Thanks for listening.
Nice. Ha ha ha.